Then Jesus was led by the Spirit into the desert to be tempted by the devil. After fasting for 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry. The tempter came to him and said, "If you are the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread." Jesus answered, "It is written, man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God." Then the devil took him to the holy city and had him stand on the highest point of the temple. "If you are the Son of God," he said, "throw yourself down, for it is written, he will command his angels concerning you, and they will lift you up in their hands, so that you will not strike your foot against a stone." Jesus answered him, "It is also written, do not put the Lord your God to the test." Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world in their splendor. "All this I will give you," he said, "if you will bow down and worship me." Jesus said to him, "Away from me, Satan, for it is written, worship the Lord your God and serve him only." Then the devil left him, and angels came and attended him. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Lekker, as we say in Afrikaans. Richard, all yours.
So, Sean Parker, do you know him? If not, you probably know the other guy. Mark Zuckerberg, you know him? Of Facebook fame. He currently has $80 billion in his bank account, or probably not in his bank account, according in the shares that he's got, which is quite a fair amount of money. Sean started Facebook with him. He left a little bit sooner, and so he only has $2.5 billion in his bank account. Yeah. Poor him. But the two of them have started an incredible revolution in our culture, or are part of a group of young people who have initiated an incredible revolution in our culture, which affects every single one of us every single day. And I want us to think about it. Sean recently has been thinking about the impact of the work that he did as a younger man, maybe a decade ago, and he spoke at a conference, and he said this. The thought process behind building the Facebook was this: how can we consume as much of your time and conscious attention as possible? That was the aim, to consume as much of your time and attention as possible. The means that we needed to sort out, this means that we needed to give you a sort of dopamine, a little dopamine hit every once in a while when someone liked or commented on a photo or a post or whatever. It's like social validation feedback loop. It's exactly the kind of thing a hacker like myself would come up with, because you're exploiting a vulnerability in human psychology. The inventors understood this consciously, and we did it anyway. So it's rare for these guys to begin to show what they're really thinking behind the scenes. But this is what is behind that thing called Facebook. I'm after your attention this evening, because this is the thing that everyone else is after too. In fact, the economy of attention is the thing that people are willing to put a lot of money into. And in fact, your attention is making more money on behalf of these big organizations and corporate organizations and businesses than anything else. Your attention is the thing that they are after. And we notice it every single time something flips up on our phone with a little red sticker saying, "Here's a notification," and our attention is taken away. Jesus, in contrast, says, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle in heart." I love that phrase. "I'm gentle in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light." He also says, "The thief comes only to steal, kill, and destroy. I have come that they may have life and life in all its fullness, or have it to the full. The thief comes. Last week, as you listened to God, on my behalf, some of you came up with some thoughts about what you think God might be saying. And I think it was Melanie who said that she saw a picture of barbed wire and of, I think the image was of me in protecting people from, or sheep, from getting too close to the barbed wire. And there was something about making sure that there was a distance kept between the sheep and the danger. And I think that speaks of tonight's talk. I think that says something into tonight's talk. I think there is some barbed wire that we need to pay attention to in our culture. And I think the purpose of tonight is to say this is a danger for us, and we should avoid it. Unless you want to get hurt, that is. Which, of course, none of us want to get hurt. There are a couple of books I'm going to mention tonight. One is this one by David Kinnaman and Mark Matlock, who work for an organization called Barna. Have you heard of Barna? They're like Maury, and they do lots of surveys of people, and they do it mostly in America, and they do a lot of work for Christian organizations, but not exclusively, in order to find out what we think. And they have been noting, like we all have, about the decline of younger people, 23 to 30, from going to church. They've noticed that decline, and they wanted to find out, well, interestingly, that instead of just asking people what was it that made you leave, they've done that survey too, they asked people who have stayed, those people within those age brackets between 23 and 30, what keeps you in the church? And what are the practices that you do that make it possible for you to stay in the church? When everyone else is leaving, how come you're staying? And so they've written this book, and you'll see underneath it says, 5 Ways a New Generation Can Follow Jesus in Digital Babylon. What's interesting for me is the phrase digital Babylon. And here's their explanation. We are the first generation of humans who cannot rely on the earned wisdom of previous generations to help us live with these rapid technological changes. The digital comes from the technological changes that are happening around us. We have adopted a phrase to describe our accelerated and complex culture. Certainly, I think we'd all put our hands up to that. That is marked by phenomenal access, profound alienation, and a crisis of authority. And the phrase we've come up with is digital Babylon, that sense of being in exile under an oppressive regime that is bigger and more powerful than us, of which we are a slave. But in our context, it is the digital technological world that is oppressing us. Interesting phrase. Interesting. I looked up in my research, thinking about this evening, for various things about attention, and I came across this website for Saber. I don't sure how you say it even, Saber, Digital Creative, which is a marketing company. I don't know what they're like or what they do, but this is their blurb that they had on one of their pages. The millennial generation is like none we've ever seen before. You familiar with the term millennial generation? Are some of you familiar? You've heard of it? The children of baby boomers is the millennial generation. Do you heard of baby boomers? Okay. This generation has been raised with technology in their hands, higher education at their fingertips, and diversity all around them. Defined as people born between 1980 and 2000, this generation is more comfortable with interactions that happen online or via text rather than in person. On the whole, they are more liberal, less religious, less patriotic, and less likely to get married young, if at all. Because of their dissimilarity to the generations that came before, they require a new set of rules when it comes to grabbing their attention, gaining their loyalty, and getting them to buy. Which is an interesting kind of narrative for what it means to be a marketing company, but we'll leave that to one side. I'm not sure every marketing company would think that that's their purpose or raison d'etre. But for this one, obviously it's speaking into a mindset that people are coming looking for some ways of breaking into this generation to help them to purchase goods and products that they might want to sell them. And you've got to work differently for this group if you're going to get their attention. And it says, millennials are as diverse as their iPhone cases. They want to be wooed, convinced, and called out and complimented for their individualized taste. The challenge is to figure out which among them you want to draw in and what about your product will make them want to make it. What about your product will make them want to make it their own? But the tools that they offer are these. These are the tools this company and many others will offer people and say, we can give you access to this millennial generation through these tools. This is how we will access those people and you will be able to market your resources or the products that you want to sell. There's this very handsome man with a great haircut and some even better glasses than mine called Seth Godin. Anyone heard of Seth Godin? He's a bit of a guru. Yeah, some of you have heard of him. Yeah, he's really interesting to speak on. He's also another businessy guy into marketing, but he's more than that. He's a bit of a thinker. He's written a number of books, 17 books, I think. And he's, as well as running businesses and becoming, you know, very successful financially, but he writes a blog every single... Do you remember blogs? We used to read blogs, didn't we, in the heady days of the 19-something or others. Anyway, but he still writes a blog every single day, and there was one that came out in December 2016, which was entitled this. It made a bit of a stir. When Your Phone Uses You was the title of the blog page. Your smartphone has two jobs. On the one hand, it was hired by you to accomplish certain tasks, like a light or a phone or a map. In the scheme of things, it's a screaming bargain and a miracle, which it is. But most of the time, your phone works for corporations, assorted acquaintances, and large social media networks. They've hired it to put you to work for them. You're not the customer, you're the product. Your attention and your anxiety is getting sold cheap. Really interesting. Think about it. When your phone grabs your attention, when it makes you feel inadequate, when it pushes you to catch up, to consume and to fret, it's not working for you, is it? On demand doesn't mean you do things when the device demands, or does it? Tristan Harris is an ex-Google ethicist. Google has ethicists within its team. And that made me surprised and interested, and but that makes sense as well, because Google changes things. When Google posts some things, when it changes the algorithm, different things happen in the world, and very significant things happen in the world. So they know that their data isn't neutral. They know their data has a big impact on stuff. When you put certain words in, it can direct you or not direct you towards other things. So that means that that's a bit of an ethical decision to be made about how you deal with data. It's not neutral. So they hired this guy called Tristan, or he was already working in the company already, and they promoted him or gave him this job of becoming an ethicist for the company. And he has recently stopped working for Google, which is why he's an ex-Google ethicist, because he became convinced that the ethics were not humane. And he's now started up a new charity called Humane Technology, and he tries to recruit people from within the technological companies in order to think, how can we make our technology more humane? Because he saw within it a poison working through it that was making technology unhumane, working against us as humanity. But he describes the whole technological revolution as the attention economy. And he says behind that attention economy is what he calls persuasive technologies. Now, I didn't know what persuasive technologies were, so I've had to kind of find out, but they're those things. When you weren't thinking about them, and then something happens, and then you start thinking about them, and you swipe your phone, you change direction, you do something. You know what I mean by a persuasive technology? Another example of a persuasive technology is the bit over here which says autoplay. Can you see that tiny little bit where the blue button is? It says autoplay. Now, I didn't know that YouTube has changed the way it does things, although I did by experience, but no one told me. They just do these things, don't they? But I had noticed that when you finish a YouTube, then you get you get a new option coming up, and you have a few seconds to choose whether you want the next video to play automatically or not. Did you notice that? You've noticed that. And it's surprising how often we do watch the next one coming around. And what YouTube have noticed is because YouTube want to buy your attention, they want your attention as much as possible. That's what they want. So it used to stop, and now it carries on. And guess what happens? We keep watching. So they noticed that I was watching Tristan Harris on the fight for our attention, which was the guy I've just been talking about. And then up comes this new one, which says, why do you check your phone 150 times a day? Which is kind of closely related to the previous one, and it keeps my interest going, doesn't it? You can see what they're thinking. Good guess from their algorithms. They've worked me out. And because you can see what I'm interested in on this side down here, because this is... So last dramatic last ball win, England wins the decider. That was a good YouTube. Van tours, I have a camper van and I look at other people's camper vans. Shimano brakes for the first time is easy. I'm not quite sure why I have cycling stuff in my stuff, but anyway, I do. And then we drove these electric cars until they died. Another car thing, which is another stream that they seem to send me quite a lot of, and I seem to find myself watching. I digress. I would love to see what's on the side of yours if you're judging me. Yes, this is confession. So this is a persuasive technology which nudges you into behavior that you wouldn't otherwise do. You weren't intending to watch three YouTubes in a row. You just wanted to watch one, but you found yourself watching more than you wanted. That's persuasion. Now, that's not all bad. I mean, there's a lot of good governmental practice even, trying to persuade you to use stairs rather than escalators, or to eat less high-fat food or high-sugar food. And these are all persuasive technologies. Well, so there are good things to this idea, but you can also see how they're vulnerable to exploitation in all sorts of ways, particularly when it comes to our attention. And so there's this guy who's a professor of marketing, and he teaches marketing, so he helps young students to learn how to be good at marketing. But he's noticed that there's something going on in the culture around him that he's less comfortable with. And so he wrote this book, Irresistible: The Rise of Addictive Technology and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. He's noticed that there's something that is like a gambling machine, like those one-armed bandits that you used to have in the seaside, that keeps us coming back for more again and again and again. And he says what's stopped, what's changed, is that there are no stopping cues. And I didn't know what a stopping cue was until he told me. And a stopping cue is that bit. Well, we used to have them in books. Do you remember books? They had chapters in. Do you remember chapters? And a chapter is that bit when you come to the end, you think, okay, I can have a break now. I can put the book down, go and have a cup of tea, or I can put the book down and put it back, come back to it tomorrow, put the bookmark in because I know where the chapter lies. Whereas in a Kindle, it doesn't have a chapter mark. It does have a chapter mark, but it's always creeping up to the next page anyway. You're swiping. So every page is the same as the last page. It feels very similar. Or a newspaper has a stopping cue because you get to the end of the article and then there's no other sports articles to read. So you put the newspaper down. It's no longer useful for anything other than fish and chips. So, so that's the stopping cue. And he's saying that those stopping cues have been taken out of the addictive technologies of our smartphones and our computers. They don't want you to stop, they want to keep you going. So have you noticed how on BBC iPlayer, anyone use BBC iPlayer? The force is with you, I see. Yeah. So what happens is after you watch an episode of whatever it is, however young or old you are, you have 12 seconds to make up your mind at the end of that thing about whether you want to watch the next episode. Is that right? And what happens? You watch the next episode. You only wanted to watch one episode, but you find yourself watching the next episode, and then even the next episode. There's a lot of sinners down here. It's not sin to do that. It's not a bad thing. But I can see, it's interesting, isn't it, that this thing has a power over us. What's interesting is that it is buying our attention without our permission, or at least our intentional permission. It's nudging us to stay with them. They know that we've got a limited amount of attention. We sleep for 7 or 8 hours a night. We work for 9 hours a day. We have a bit of time to do things like shopping and look after children after school and all those kinds of things. And then we have a bit more of our attention space, which is free and adaptable. And they want that. They've learned also how to take the chunk of time that children have within schools, and somehow they manage to use this stuff anyway. But that's a digression. But they, and also people at work, also they manage to nick our time in work, and we find ourselves. Some of you, anyway, I can see your look in your face. He's talking to me. But the attention bit they want is your free attention time. And they know that they've only got so much of that left. There's a finite amount of your attention. And so they keep pushing you and pushing you, nudging you to give more of your attention to them. Now, this is not good for us, and we need stopping cues. And so this company in Denmark, what they've done at 6 o'clock, the tables will, on these lines that I've put a red arrow, yeah, they start rising at 6 o'clock. There's no noise, it just goes, and so whatever you're doing, the desk starts rising. In order to say, it's time to go home. But I'm in the middle of an email. And it turns into a yoga studio one night and a dance studio the next night or something like that. Really interesting. In other words, because they know that without it, you would just keep on going. Another attempt is Daimler holiday email policy. Have you heard about this? This is really interesting. This is, you know, when you go on holiday, you set up your emails to say, I'm no longer going to read your emails. Slight lie, but you say it anyway. I'm no longer, because I'm out of the office. Well, Daimler have changed that. They said, what we're going to do is when you go out on holiday, we're going to tell people, and we're actually going to do it. We're going to delete their emails. When they send you an email and you're on holiday, we'll delete your email. And this is what they send you. So this is the holiday email you get back. I'm on vacation. I cannot read your email. Your email is being deleted. Please contact Hans or Monica if it's really important, or resend the email after I'm back in the office. Danke schön. Monica, you see? Now, can you imagine what it would be like to be an employee of that company and be on holiday? You would be on holiday. In contrast, there are many others of us who set up our little out-of-office things, but we take these things along with us and we find the little notifications coming up on our phones and we still feel that we need to respond in some way. If nothing else, just to get rid of the red mark, the red notification, to get it down to zero. We'll read it later, but we'll just get rid of the red dot. Anyone else? Thank you for your honesty. What would it be like? Why do we need to do this kind of stuff? Well, it's because we have attention deficit disorder. I'm not sure if that's quite how that word was intended, but it feels to me significant. Now, it's for all ages. Anyone recognize this logo? Yes, it's. I actually have no idea about this, but I'm out of my depth, but it's apparently what the young people use. It's called Snapchat. Have you heard of Snapchat? You send pictures, don't you? It's not like text. You have to send a picture and then then a bit of text with it. Is that right? Can you send text on its own? Oh, you can do either. Okay, thanks. Okay, I've learned something. Well, there's this thing called, what's it called? Snap streaks. Snapchat streaks, where you get, so if I sent something to Joel and then he Snapchat me back, and we did that one day, and then I did it the second day, I'd get we're in a streak of 2 days. And then if we did it 3 days, backwards and forwards, then it would be 3 days, 4 days. And so what that does is it gives a little little incentive to us to keep going, because we like the idea of having been on Snapchat streak and getting our Snapchat streak up, because that makes us feel like we're really close and we're friends with each other. Imagine if we do that for Well, let me read this. Instagram likes are great, hearts or messages are fine, but the one metric by which many teens live and die by is snap streak. A Snapchat streak is when you send direct snaps backwards and forward with a friend for several consecutive days. The longer you go without breaking the chain of communication, the longer your streak is. Snapchat, I can't even say the word, rewards longer streaks with special emojis such as the 100 emoji for streaks lasting 100 days, or a mountain emoji for extremely long streaks. Many teens invest an inordinate amount of time keeping streaks alive. There's nothing more devastating than losing a streak you've put months of work into. 100 is 3 months' work. You're not going to give that number up lightly, so you keep sending something day after day. So I've heard, and this is backed up by some school evidence over here, Sarah was talking about it before the service, and that children will give their passwords to other people so that when they are no longer able to get to their phone, someone else can Snapchat on their behalf to keep the streak going. Has anyone done that in the room? You're not going to admit to it, are you? No. But Sarah was saying that this at her school, where parents are wise, mature adults and earning good money, and they're trying to bring their kids up in the best possible way, in the best possible education they could possibly afford, that in that place, the kids go absolutely ballistic when you take their phones away because their snap streak might drop off. Now, what would you say that was? I would call it an addiction. Have you opened a packet of crisps recently? Now, you understand this, even if you've never been to any technology. You know that as soon as you open a packet of crisps, it empties itself very quickly, doesn't it? You can't leave a packet of crisps half-filled, roll up the top, put a peg on it, and put it back in the cupboard very easily. It doesn't work like that. There are no half-empty bags of crisps in your cupboards. They are all empty or in the bin, or they're full. You know that as soon as you... And the bigger, what they've done is they've now made crisp packets bigger, and so we now eat more crisps. It is impossible, however big the bag is, to just leave it half empty. This is the same with the technologies. It is so enticing that we cannot get enough of it, and we keep going, we keep going, we keep going, we keep going. 72% of teens and 48% of parents feel the need to immediately respond to texts, social networking messages, and other notifications. Now, which is the worst figure, the 72 or the 48? It's interesting, isn't it, that it's not just our kids, it's us as adults, as parents, who are discipling our children in this technology. We're as addicted to this stuff as our children. 57% of children under 16 always have the phone beside their bed. I mean, this is a BBC statistic. I mean, that just seems phenomenal. 57% of children under 16 always have the phone beside their bed, and 44% of them feel uncomfortable if they're ever without a phone signal. The Wi-Fi's gone cold. The Wi-Fi's broken is a terrible curse for anyone, for all of us, but for anyone under 30, isn't it? I mean, it's just terrible if you can't get Wi-Fi. Our biggest competitors are Facebook, YouTube, and sleep, said the CEO of Netflix. And they recognize that if they've got a bit of your attention, then we haven't. And so if they've got your attention, well, then sleep is the next thing we will try. And we're sleeping with these things right by our ears and our beds. This sacred space of rest is being invaded by this thing from outside. So Tristan Harris says, the attention economy incentivizes the design of technologies that grab our attention, and in so doing, it privileges our impulses over our intentions. Impulses over intentions. These two words, good words, impulses and intentions. What's an impulse? It's something that drives you. It's like a spike of energy that is very significant. And these are the kinds of things that get an immediate response to us. Fear, anger, pleasure, or approval. Is that not the internet? You hear a story of fear. You hear a story that makes you angry. And of course, the internet, what does it do? It turns up the outrage. Here's an outrageous headline, and you're drawn to it. It's not mild headlines. We don't read the mild headlines. We're drawn to the wild ones. And of course, the internet is filled with things that are going to offer us pleasure. And of course, pornography is a massive thing in our culture. And it's there all the time. And our kids are very, very susceptible to being addicted to pornography. And of course, the approval of social media is fascinating, isn't it, that we're hungry for this approval and yet we're the least secure than we've ever been. And it's like these things are not feeding us. And yet this is what the stuff is giving us all the time. The extractive attention economy, extractive in that it takes something from us, is tearing apart our shared social fabric. The companies that created social media and mobile tech have benefited our lives enormously, let's not deny it. But even with the best intentions, they are under intense pressure to compete for attention, creating invisible harms for our society. He lists six, let's just whiz through them. Digital addiction, mental health, superficiality, breakdown of truth, polarization, and political manipulation. Creating discord through cyber warfare is far more cost-effective than military action. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1965, how many years ago was that, said this: how much of our modern life can be summarized in that arresting dictum of the poet Thoreau? Improved means to unimproved end. We have allowed our civilization to outrun our culture. We have allowed our technology to outdistance our theology. And for this reason, we find ourselves caught up with many problems. Speaks to us today, I think. So the book suggests that we can, and we can become the kind of resilient disciples in digital Babylon. But the first thing we need to recognize is that we are in digital Babylon. So we are baptized and immersed in a culture that is bigger than us. We are like exiles in a foreign land, like a Jew in Babylon, like a guy from Israel named Daniel and brought to become in Nebuchadnezzar's court. We are like that. As Christians, we live in exile in a culture which is immersive. We live in it. It is everywhere. Hegemonic, if that means anything to you. And Jesus calls us into a different way of being alive. And he calls us to be with him, to become like him, and to begin to do the things that he did. What Jesus does is he baptizes us into another culture, another way of being human, which means to leave your present culture and to be re-immersed or baptized in another context. This is the kingdom of God versus the kingdom of darkness, the light versus dark, that is written all the way through the New Testament. So what does that mean for our technology? Well, I wonder if we should pay more attention to our technology and see it as more dangerous than we currently do. Do you know the passage from James about the tongue? You know, your tongue is very powerful. It's a small thing, but it makes a big difference. I've switched the word tongue for smartphone. Should we have some fun and see what happens? This is what happens when you switch it. We all stumble in many ways. Anyone who is never at fault in what they use their phone for is perfect, able to keep their whole selves in check. When we put bits into the mouths of horses to make them obey us, we can turn the whole animal. Or take ships as an example. Although they are so large and are driven by strong winds, they are steered by a very small rudder wherever the pilot wants to go. Likewise, the smartphone is small, but it makes great boasts. This works, doesn't it? This is good. Consider what a great forest is set on fire by a small spark. The smartphone also is a fire, a world of evil apart among the parts of the body. It corrupts the whole body, sets the whole course of one's life on fire, and is itself set on fire by hell. Quite strong, but I think probably on balance, true. All kinds of animals, birds, reptiles, and sea creatures are being tamed and have been tamed by mankind, but no human being can tame the smartphone. It is a restless evil, full of deadly poison. With the smartphone, we praise the Lord, our Father, and with it we curse human beings. Now, isn't that a truth? The same thing that sings, raise a hallelujah, is the same thing that texts an abusive remark to someone across the world. Out of the same device comes praise and cursing. My brothers and sisters, this should not be. Can both fresh water and salt water flow from the same spring? My brothers and sisters, can a fig tree bear olives or a grapevine bear figs? Neither can a salt spring produce fresh water. I was wondering, because we're going to update the notice board outside and maybe put my name on the front, which was nice. But we also wondered about putting Facebook and Instagram and other links to that. But I'm now thinking that maybe we shouldn't. You know, if people really want to find us, they can find us. And, you know, we'll have an Instagram account, we'll have a Facebook account, and that's fine and that's good. But maybe we don't need to advertise this stuff. Just tell them what time the services are, and maybe that's enough. Restfulness and restlessness, and in the middle of this list of restlessness was this word distraction, and I think it's the one that we need to pay attention to, and I think it's the one that God is calling us to be aware of. One of the greatest challenges of our day for our discipleship is the fight for our attention. We become what we give our attention to, said Epictetus a long time ago. Or Ken Blanchard said, what we give our attention to grows. So the passage that we read at the beginning is a story of Jesus being led by the Spirit into the wilderness in order to sharpen up his attention. Did you notice how the enemy showed him various things and drew his attention to various other distractions that were against his trajectory, against what his calling was, and each time he resisted these distractions with the Word of God. We need to be trained by the Spirit, and we need to learn how to be able to fight resiliently against these distractions, which means we need to take control of this thing in our pocket. Jesus said, when you fast. Not if you fast, but when you fast. You'll see on your notice sheet that there's a shared way of fasting this coming month during Lent. And you might want to join with others to fast from food, and maybe also from your smartphone or other devices, in order to give yourself space to be with God. 6:30 on a Monday morning, fasting with others, praying with them in order to give your attention to God. Or 9:15 if you don't want to do that so early. And here's my version. Pay attention to what you pay attention to. My suggestion is that over the course of Lent that you notice where your hands are going, where your eyes are going, what's taking your time, what's taking your attention at work, at home. My last book, and I'm finishing up now, is this one called The Benedict Option by a guy called Rod Dreher. It's a challenging read, and he is making the case for a strategy for Christians in a post-Christian nation. So he's noticing that we're exiles in a similar sort of way, and he's saying, how can we become resilient? And he says, we must become like Benedict. We must get together in really strong groups and communities where we practice the rules of being faithful to Jesus again and again and again. Prayer, study, work, play. But we must do this in a very organized, we must do it very intentionally. We must discover new ways of living faithfully, or else the culture will win over us. But he says this, a church that looks and talks and sounds just like the world has no reason to exist. And you know, I reckon that we're probably identical to our brothers and sisters who live in the streets around us in terms of our computer use and how much we're distracted by this stuff. We've got to stand out in some way. Christians often talk about reaching the culture without realizing that having no distinct Christian culture of their own, they have been co-opted by the secular culture they wish to evangelize. As Paul put it, the fruit of the Spirit is self-control, So we need to ask the Spirit to come upon us, to give us control over this most powerful of forces. He goes on to say, developing the cognitive control that leads to a more contemplative Christian life is the key to living as free men and women in post-Christian America. The man whose desires are under control of his reason is free. The man who does whatever occurs to him is a slave. Hear, O Israel, Shema, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. These commandments I give you today are to be on your hearts. Impress them on your children. When would you do this? How would you do this? Well, you talk about it when you sit at home, and when you walk along the road, when you lie down, and when you get up. Give them your attention. Share your life with them. Teach them how to pray, how to be still, how to get through boredom, how to deal with conflict. Tie them as symbols on your hand and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and upon your gates. And finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. Whatever you learned or received or heard from me or seen in me, well, put it into practice. And then the God of peace, the yoke that comes from Jesus, will be with you. We have a task to do together, to help each other in, to become free of this stuff, and to think about what is good and true and beautiful. Amen. Amen.